or city of Nagasaki. Does this influence the choice of this target for initial centerboard operation? Request immediate reply. The reply. Targets previously assigned for centerboard remain unchanged. True, the war then ended quickly. Italy had been defeated a year earlier. Germany had recently surrendered, crushed primarily by the armies of the Soviet Union on the Eastern Front, aided by the Allied armies on the West. Now Japan surrendered. The fascist powers were destroyed. But what about fascism, as idea, as reality? Were its essential elements, militarism, racism, imperialism, now gone? Or were they absorbed into the already poisoned bones of the victors? A.J. Musty, the revolutionary pacifist, had predicted in 1941, "The problem after a war is with the victor. He thinks he has just proved that war and violence pay. Who will now teach him a lesson?" The victors were the Soviet Union and the United States. Also, England, France, and nationalist China, but they were weak. Both these countries now went to work, without swastikas, goose-stepping, or officially declared racism, but under the cover of socialism on one side and democracy on the other, to carve out their own empires of influence. They proceeded to share and contest with one another the domination of the world, to build military machines far greater than the fascist countries had built, to control the destinies of more countries than Hitler, Mussolini, and Japan had been able to do. They also acted to control their own populations, each country with its own techniques, crude in the Soviet Union, sophisticated in the United States, to make their rule secure. The war not only put the United States in a position to dominate much of the world, it created conditions for effective control at home. The unemployment, the economic distress, and the consequent turmoil that had marked the 30s, only partly relieved by New Deal measures, had been pacified, overcome by the greater turmoil of the war. The war brought higher prices for farmers, higher wages, enough prosperity for enough of the population to assume against the rebellions that so threatened the 30s. As Lawrence Wittner writes, the war rejuvenated American capitalism. The biggest gains were in corporate profits, which rose from $6.4 billion in 1940 to $10.8 billion in 1944. But enough went to workers and farmers to make them feel the system was doing well for them. It was an old lesson learned by governments that war solves problems of control. Charles E. Wilson, the president of General Electric Corporation, was so happy about the wartime situation that he suggested a continuing alliance between business and the military for a permanent war economy. That is what happened. When right after the war, the American public, war-weary, seemed to favor demobilization and disarmament, the Truman administration, Roosevelt had died in April 1945, worked to create an atmosphere of crisis and Cold War. True, the rivalry with the Soviet Union was real. That country had come out of the war with its economy wrecked and 20 million people dead, but was making an astounding comeback, rebuilding its industry, regaining military strength. The Truman administration, however, presented the Soviet Union as not just a rival, but an immediate threat. In a series of moves abroad and at home, it established a climate of fear, a hysteria about communism, which would steeply escalate the military budget and stimulate the economy with war-related orders. This combination of policies would permit more aggressive actions abroad, more repressive actions at home. Revolutionary movements in Europe and Asia were described to the American public as examples of Soviet expansionism, thus recalling the indignation against Hitler's aggressions. In Greece, which had been a right-wing monarchy and dictatorship before the war, a popular left-wing National Liberation Front, the EAM, was put down by a British army of intervention immediately after the war. A right-wing dictatorship was restored. When opponents of the regime were jailed and trade union leaders removed, a left-wing guerrilla movement began to grow against the regime, soon consisting of 17,000 fighters, 50,000 active supporters, and perhaps 250,000 sympathizers in a country of 7 million. Great Britain said it could not handle the rebellion and asked the United States to come in. As a State Department officer said later, Great Britain had within the hour handed the job of world leadership to the United States. The United States responded with the Truman Doctrine, the name given to a speech Truman gave to Congress in the spring of 1947, in which he asked for $400 million in military and economic aid to Greece and Turkey. Truman said the U.S. must help free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. In fact, the biggest outside pressure was the United States. The Greek rebels were getting some aid from Yugoslavia, but no aid from the Soviet Union, which during the war had promised Churchill a free hand in Greece if he would give the Soviet Union its way in Romania, Poland, Bulgaria. The Soviet Union, like the United States, did not seem to be willing to help revolutions it could not control. Truman said the world must choose between alternative ways of life. One was based on the will of the majority, distinguished by free institutions. The other was based on the will of a minority, terror and oppression, the suppression of personal freedoms. Truman's advisor, Clark Clifford, had suggested that in his message, Truman connect the intervention in Greece to something less rhetorical, more practical. The great natural resources of the Middle East. Clifford meant oil. But Truman didn't mention that. The United States moved into the Greek Civil War, not with soldiers, but with weapons and military advisors. In the last 5 months of 1947, 74,000 tons of military equipment were sent by the United States to the right-wing government in Athens, including artillery, dive bombers, and stocks of napalm. 250 army officers, headed by General James Van Fleet, advised the Greek army in the field. Van Fleet started a policy, standard in dealing with popular insurrections, of forcibly removing thousands of Greeks from their homes in the countryside, to try to isolate the guerrillas, to remove the source of their support. With that aid, the rebellion was defeated by 1949. United States economic and military aid continued to the Greek government. Investment capital from Esso, Dow Chemical, Chrysler, and other U.S. corporations flowed into Greece. But illiteracy, poverty, and starvation remained widespread there, with the country in the hands of what Richard Barnett, Intervention and Revolution, called a particularly brutal and backward military dictatorship. In China, a revolution was already underway when World War II ended, led by a communist movement with enormous mass support. A Red Army, which had fought against the Japanese, now fought to oust the corrupt dictatorship of Chiang Kai-shek, which was supported by the United States. The United States, by 1949, had given $2 billion in aid to Chiang Kai-shek's forces. But, according to the State Department's own white paper on China, Chiang Kai-shek's government had lost the confidence of its own troops and its own people. In January 1949, Chinese communist forces moved into Peking. The Civil War was over, and China was in the hands of a revolutionary movement, the closest thing in the long history of that ancient country to a people's government, independent of outside control. The United States was trying, in the post-war decade, to create a national consensus, excluding the radicals who could not support a foreign policy aimed at suppressing revolution, of conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats, around the policies of Cold War and anti-communism. Such a coalition could best be created by a liberal democratic president whose aggressive policy abroad would be supported by conservatives and whose welfare programs at home, Truman's Fair Deal, would be attractive to liberals. If, in addition, liberals and traditional Democrats could, the memory of the war was still fresh, support a foreign policy against aggression, the radical liberal bloc created by World War II would be broken up. And perhaps, if the anti-communist mood became strong enough, liberals could support repressive moves at home, which in ordinary times would be seen as violating the liberal tradition of tolerance. In 1950, there came an event that speeded the formation of the liberal-conservative consensus: Truman's undeclared war in Korea. Korea, occupied by Japan for 35 years, was liberated from Japan after World War II and divided into North Korea, a socialist dictatorship, part of the Soviet sphere of influence, and South Korea, a right-wing dictatorship in the American sphere. There had been threats back and forth between the two Koreas, and when on June 25, 1950, North Korean armies moved southward across the 38th parallel in an invasion of South Korea, the United Nations, dominated by the United States, asked its members to help repel the armed attack. Truman ordered the American armed forces to help South Korea, and the American army became the UN army. Truman said, "A return to the rule of force in international affairs would have far-reaching effects. The United States will continue to uphold the rule of law." The United States' response to the rule of force was to reduce Korea, North and South, to a shambles in 3 years of bombing and shelling. Napalm was dropped, and a BBC journalist described the result. "In front of us, a curious figure was standing, a little crouched, legs straddled, arms held out from his sides. He had no eyes, and the whole of his body, nearly all of which was visible through tatters of burnt rags, was covered with a hard black crust, speckled with yellow pus. He had to stand because he was no longer covered with a skin, but with a crust-like crackling which broke easily. I thought of the hundreds of villages reduced to ash, which I had personally seen, and realized the sort of casualty list which must be mounting up along the Korean front. Perhaps 2 million Koreans, North and South, were killed in the Korean War, all in the name of opposing the rule of force. As for the rule of law Truman spoke about, the American military move seemed to go beyond that. The UN resolution had called for action to repel the armed attack and to restore peace and security in the area. But the American armies, after pushing the North Koreans back across the 38th parallel, advanced all the way up through North Korea to the Yalu River on the border of China, which provoked the Chinese into entering the war. The Chinese then swept southward, and the war was stalemated at the 38th parallel, until peace negotiations restored, in 1953, the old boundary between North and South. The Korean War mobilized liberal opinion behind the war and the president. It created the kind of coalition that was needed to sustain a policy of intervention abroad, militarization of the economy at home. This meant trouble for those who stayed outside the coalition as radical critics. Alonzo Hamby noted, beyond the New Deal, that the Korean War was supported by the New Republic, by the Nation, and by Henry Wallace, who in 1948 had run against Truman on a left coalition Progressive Party ticket. The liberals didn't like Senator Joseph McCarthy, who hunted for communists everywhere, even among liberals. But the Korean War, as Hamby says, had given McCarthyism a new lease on life. The left had become very influential in the hard times of the 30s and during the war against fascism. The actual membership of the Communist Party was not large, fewer than 100,000 probably. but it was a potent force in trade unions numbering millions of members, in the arts, and among countless Americans who may have been led by the failure of the capitalist system in the 30s to look favorably on communism and socialism. Thus, if the establishment after World War II was to make capitalism more secure in the country and to build a consensus of support for the American empire, it had to weaken and isolate the left. 2 weeks after presenting to the country the Truman Doctrine for Greece and Turkey, Truman issued on March 22, 1947, Executive Order 9835, initiating a program to search out any infiltration of disloyal persons in the U.S. government. In their book, The 50s, Douglas Miller and Marion Nowak comment, though Truman would later complain of the great wave of hysteria sweeping the nation, his commitment to victory over communism, to completely safeguarding the United States from external and internal threats, was in large measure responsible for creating that very hysteria. Between the launching of his security program in March 1947 and December 1952, some 6.6 million persons were investigated. Not a single case of espionage was uncovered, though about 500 persons were dismissed in dubious cases of questionable loyalty. All of this was conducted with secret evidence, secret and often paid informers, and neither judge nor jury. Despite the failure to find subversion, the broad scope of the official Red Hunt gave popular credence to the notion that the government was riddled with spies. A conservative and fearful reaction coursed the country. Americans became convinced of the need for absolute security and the preservation of the established order. World events right after the war made it easier to build up public support for the anti-communist crusade at home. In 1948, the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia ousted non-communists from the government and established their own rule. The Soviet Union that year blockaded Berlin, which was a jointly occupied city isolated inside the Soviet sphere of East Germany, forcing the United States to airlift supplies into Berlin. In 1949, there was the communist victory in China. And in that year also, the Soviet Union exploded its first atomic bomb. In 1950, the Korean War began. These were all portrayed to the public as signs of a world communist conspiracy. Not as publicized as the communist victories, but just as disturbing to the American government, was the upsurge all over the world of colonial peoples demanding independence. Revolutionary movements were growing, in Indochina against the French, in Indonesia against the Dutch, in the Philippines, armed rebellion against the United States. In Africa, there were rumblings of discontent in the form of strikes. Basil Davidson, Let Freedom Come, tells of the longest recorded strike, 160 days, in African history, of 19,000 railway men in French West Africa in 1947, whose message to the Governor General showed the new mood of militancy. Open your prisons, make ready your machine guns and cannon. Nevertheless, at midnight on 10th of October, if our demands are not met, we declare the general strike. The year before, in South Africa, 100,000 gold mine workers stopped work, demanding 10 shillings, about $2.50, a day in wages. The greatest strike in the history of South Africa. And it took a military attack to get them back to work. In 1950, in Kenya, there was a general strike against starvation wages. So it was not just Soviet expansion that was threatening to the United States government and to American business interests. In fact, China, Korea, Indochina, the Philippines represented local communist movements, not Russian fomentation. It was a general wave of anti-imperialist insurrection in the world, which would require gigantic American effort to defeat, national unity for militarization of the budget, for the suppression of domestic opposition to such a foreign policy. Truman and the liberals in Congress proceeded to try to create a new national unity for the post-war years with the executive order on loyalty oaths, Justice Department prosecutions, and anti-communist legislation. In this atmosphere, Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin could go even further than Truman. Speaking to a women's Republican club in Wheeling, West Virginia in early 1950, he held up some papers and shouted, "I have here in my hand a list of 205, a list of names that were made known to the Secretary of State as being members of the Communist Party and who nevertheless are still working and shaping policy in the State Department." The next day, speaking in Salt Lake City, McCarthy claimed he had a list of 57, the number kept changing, such communists in the State Department. Shortly afterward, he appeared on the floor of the Senate with photostatic copies of about 100 dossiers from State Department loyalty files. The dossiers were 3 years old, and most of the people were no longer with the State Department. But McCarthy read from them anyway, inventing, adding, and changing as he read. In one case, he changed the dossier's description of liberal to communistically inclined. In another form, active fellow traveler to active communist, and so on. McCarthy kept on like this for the next few years. As chairman of the Permanent Investigations Subcommittee of a Senate Committee on Government Operations, he investigated the State Department's information program, its Voice of America, and its overseas libraries, which included books by people McCarthy considered communists. The State Department reacted in panic, issuing a stream of directives to its library centers across the world. 40 books were removed, including The Selected Works of Thomas Jefferson, edited by Philip Foner, and The Children's Hour by Lillian Hellman. Some books were burned. McCarthy became bolder. In the spring of 1954, he began hearings to investigate supposed subversives in the military. When he began attacking generals for not being hard enough on suspected communists, he antagonized Republicans as well as Democrats. And in December 1954, the Senate voted overwhelmingly to censure him for conduct unbecoming a member of the United States Senate. The censure resolution avoided criticizing McCarthy's anti-communist lies and exaggerations. It concentrated on minor matters, on his refusal to appear before a Senate subcommittee on privileges and elections, and his abuse of an army general at his hearings. At the very time the Senate was censuring McCarthy, Congress was putting through a whole series of anti-communist bills. Liberal Hubert Humphrey introduced an amendment to one of them to make the Communist Party illegal, saying, "I do not intend to be a half-patriot. Either senators are for recognizing the Communist Party for what it is, or they will continue to trip over the niceties of legal technicalities and details." The liberals in the government were themselves acting to exclude, persecute, fire, and even imprison communists. It was just that McCarthy had gone too far, attacking not only communists, but liberals, endangering that broad liberal-conservative coalition which was considered essential. For instance, Lyndon Johnson, as Senate Minority Leader, worked not only to pass the censure resolution on McCarthy, but also to keep it within the narrow bounds of conduct unbecoming a member of the United States Senate, rather than questioning McCarthy's anti-communism. John F. Kennedy was cautious on the issue, didn't speak out against McCarthy. He was absent when the censure vote was taken, and never said how he would have voted. McCarthy's insistence that communism had won in China because of softness on communism in the American government was close to Kennedy's own view, expressed in the House of Representatives, January 1949. When the Chinese communists took over Peking. Kennedy said, "Mr. Speaker, Over this weekend, we have learned the extent of the disaster that has befallen China and the United States. The responsibility for the failure of our foreign policy in the Far East rests squarely with the White House and the Department of State. The continued insistence that aid would not be forthcoming unless a coalition government with the communists was formed was a crippling blow to the national government. So concerned were our diplomats and their advisors, the Lattimores and the Fairbanks, both scholars in the field of Chinese history, Owen Lattimore, a favorite target of McCarthy, John Fairbank, a Harvard professor, with the imperfection of the democratic system in China after 20 years of war, and the tales of corruption in high places, that they lost sight of our tremendous stake in a non-communist China. This House must now assume the responsibility of preventing the onrushing tide of communism from engulfing all of Asia. When in 1950, Republicans sponsored an Internal Security Act for the registration of organizations found to be Communist Action or Communist Front, liberal senators did not fight that head-on. Instead, some of them, including Hubert Humphrey and Herbert Lehman, proposed a substitute measure, the setting up of detention centers, really concentration camps, for suspected subversives, who, when the president declared an internal security emergency, would be held without trial. The detention camp bill became not a substitute for, but an addition to, the Internal Security Act, and the proposed camps were set up, ready for use. In 1968, a time of general disillusionment with anti-communism, this law was repealed. Truman's executive order on loyalty in 1947 required the Department of Justice to draw up a list of organizations it decided were totalitarian, fascist, communist, or subversive, or as seeking to alter the form of government of the United States by unconstitutional means. Not only membership in, but also sympathetic association with any organization on the Attorney General's list would be considered in determining disloyalty. By 1954, there were hundreds of groups on this list, including, beside the Communist Party and the Ku Klux Klan, the Chopin Cultural Center, the Cervantes Fraternal Society, the Committee for the Negro in the Arts, the Committee for the Protection of the Bill of Rights, the League of American Writers, the Nature Friends of America, People's Drama, the Washington Bookshop Association, and the Yugoslav Seamen's Club. It was not McCarthy and the Republicans, but the liberal, democratic Truman administration, whose Justice Department initiated a series of prosecutions that intensified the nation's anti-communist mood. The most important of these was the prosecution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in the summer of 1950. The Rosenbergs were charged with espionage. The major evidence was supplied by a few people who had already confessed to being spies and who were either in prison or under indictment. David Greenglass, the brother of Ethel Rosenberg, was the key witness. He had been a machinist at the Manhattan Project Laboratory in Los Alamos, New Mexico, in 1944 to 1945, when the atomic bomb was being made there, and testified that Julius Rosenberg had asked him to get information for the Russians. Greenglass said he had made sketches from memory for his brother-in-law of experiments with lenses to be used to detonate atomic bombs. He said Rosenberg had given him half of the cardboard top to a box of Jell-O, and told him a man would show up in New Mexico with the other half, and that in June 1945, Harry Gold appeared with the other half of the box top, and Greenglass gave him information he had memorized. Gold, already serving a 30-year sentence in another espionage case, came out of jail to corroborate Greenglass's testimony. He had never met the Rosenbergs, but said a Soviet embassy official gave him half of a Jell-O box top and told him to contact Greenglass, saying, "I come from Julius." Gold said he took the sketches Greenglass had drawn from memory and gave them to the Russian official. There were troubling aspects to all this. Did Gold cooperate in return for early release from prison? After serving 15 years of his 30-year sentence, he was paroled. Did Greenglass, under indictment at the time he testified, also know that his life depended on his cooperation? He was given 15 years, served half of it, and was released. How reliable a memorizer of atomic information was David Greenglass? An ordinary-level machinist, not a scientist, who had taken 6 courses at Brooklyn Polytechnical Institute and flunked 5 of them. Gold's and Greenglass's stories had first not been in accord, but they were both placed on the same floor of the Tombs Prison in New York before the trial, giving them a chance to coordinate their testimony. How reliable was Gold's testimony? It turned out that he had been prepared for the Rosenberg case by 400 hours of interviews with the FBI. It also turned out that Gold was a frequent and highly imaginative liar. He was a witness in a later trial where defense counsel asked Gold about his invention of a fictional wife and fictional children. The attorney asked, "You lied for a period of 6 years." Gold responded, "I lied for a period of 16 years, not alone 6 years." Gold was the only witness at the trial to connect Julius Rosenberg and David Greenglass to the Russians. The FBI agent who had questioned Gold was interviewed 20 years after the case by a journalist. He was asked about the password Gold was supposed to have used. "Julius sent me." The FBI man said, "Gold couldn't remember the name he had given. He thought he had said, 'I come from,' or something like that. I suggested, 'Might it have been Julius?' That refreshed his memory." When the Rosenbergs were found guilty, and Judge Irving Kaufman pronounced sentence, he said, "I believe your conduct in putting into the hands of the Russians the A-bomb years before our best scientists predicted Russia would perfect the bomb has already caused the communist aggression in Korea, with the resulting casualties exceeding 50,000 Americans, and who knows but that millions more of innocent people may pay the price of your treason." He sentenced them both to die in the electric chair. Morton Sobel was also on trial as a co-conspirator with the Rosenbergs. The chief witness against him was an old friend, the best man at his wedding, a man who was facing possible perjury charges by the federal government for lying about his political past. This was Max Elitcher, who testified that he had once driven Sobel to a Manhattan housing project where the Rosenbergs lived, and that Sobel got out of the car, took from the glove compartment what appeared to be a film can, went off, and then returned without the can. There was no evidence about what was in the film can. The case against Sobel seemed so weak that Sobel's lawyer decided there was no need to present a defense. But the jury found Sobel guilty, and Kaufman sentenced him to 30 years in prison. He was sent to Alcatraz. Parole was repeatedly denied, and he spent 19 years in various prisons before he was released. FBI documents subpoenaed in the 1970s show that Judge Kaufman had conferred with the prosecutor secretly about the sentences he would give in the case. Another document shows that after 3 years of appeal, a meeting took place between Attorney General Herbert Brownell and Chief Justice Fred Vinson of the Supreme Court. And the Chief Justice assured the Attorney General that if any Supreme Court justice gave a stay of execution, he would immediately call a full court session and override it. There had been a worldwide campaign of protest. Albert Einstein, whose letter to Roosevelt early in the war had initiated work on the atomic bomb, appealed for the Rosenbergs, as did Jean-Paul Sartre, Pablo Picasso, and the sister of Bartolomeo Vanzetti. There was an appeal to President Truman just before he left office in the spring of 1953. It was turned down. Then another appeal to the new president, Dwight Eisenhower, who also turned down. At the last moment, Justice William O. Douglas granted a stay of execution. Chief Justice Vinson sent out special jets to bring the vacationing justices back to Washington from various parts of the country. They canceled Douglas's stay in time for the Rosenbergs to be executed June 19, 1953. It was a demonstration to the people of the country, though very few could identify with the Rosenbergs, of what lay at the end of the line for those the government decided were traitors. In that same period of the early 50s, the House Un-American Activities Committee was at its heyday, interrogating Americans about their communist connections, holding them in contempt if they refused to answer, distributing millions of pamphlets to the American public, 100 Things You Should Know About Communism, Where Can Communists Be Found? Everywhere. Liberals often criticized the committee, but in Congress, liberals and conservatives alike voted to fund it year after year. By 1958, only one member of the House of Representatives, James Roosevelt, voted against giving it money. Although Truman criticized the committee, his own attorney general had expressed in 1950 the same idea that motivated its investigations. There are today many communists in America. They are everywhere, in factories, offices, butcher shops, on street corners, in private business, and each carries in himself the germs of death for society. Liberal intellectuals rode the anti-communist bandwagon. Commentary magazine denounced the Rosenbergs and their supporters. One of Commentary's writers, Irving Kristol, asked in March 1952, "Do we defend our rights by protecting communists?" His answer, no. It was Truman's Justice Department that prosecuted the leaders of the Communist Party under the Smith Act, charging them with conspiring to teach and advocate the overthrow of the government by force and violence. The evidence consisted mostly of the fact that the communists were distributing Marxist-Leninist literature, which the prosecution contended called for violent revolution. There was certainly not evidence of any immediate danger of violent revolution by the Communist Party. The Supreme Court decision was given by Truman's appointee, Chief Justice Vinson. He stretched the old doctrine of the clear and present danger by saying there was a clear and present conspiracy to make a revolution at some convenient time. And so the top leadership of the Communist Party was put in prison. And soon after, most of its organizers went underground. Undoubtedly, there was success in the attempt to make the general public fearful of communists and ready to take drastic actions against them, imprisonment at home, military action abroad. The whole culture was permeated with anti-communism. The large circulation magazines had articles like, "How Communists Get That Way," and "Communists Are After Your Child." The New York Times in 1956 ran an editorial. "We would not knowingly employ a Communist Party member in the news or editorial departments because we would not trust his ability to report the news objectively or to comment on it honestly." An FBI informer's story about his exploits as a communist who became an FBI agent, "I Led Three Lives," was serialized in 500 newspapers and put on television. Hollywood movies had titles like "I Married a Communist," and "I Was a Communist for the FBI." Between 1948 and 1954, more than 40 anti-communist films came out of Hollywood. Even the American Civil Liberties Union set up specifically to defend the liberties of communists and all other political groups began to wilt in the Cold War atmosphere. It had already started in this direction back in 1940 when it expelled one of its charter members, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, because she was a member of the Communist Party. In the 50s, the ACLU was hesitant to defend Corliss Lamont, its own board member, and Owen Lattimore when both were under attack. It was reluctant to defend publicly the communist leaders during the first Smith Act trial, and kept completely out of the Rosenberg case, saying no civil liberties issues were involved. Young and old were taught that anti-communism was heroic. 3 million copies were sold of the book by Mickey Spillane, published in 1951, One Lonely Night, in which the hero, Mike Hammer, says, "I killed more people tonight than I have fingers on my hands. I shot them in cold blood and enjoyed every minute of it. They were commies, red sons of bitches who should have died long ago." A comic strip hero, Captain America, said, "Beware commies, spies, traitors, and foreign agents. Captain America, with all loyal free men behind him, is looking for you." And in the 50s, schoolchildren all over the country participated in air raid drills in which a Soviet attack on America was signaled by sirens. The children had to crouch under their desks until it was all clear. It was an atmosphere in which the government could get mass support for a policy of rearmament. The system, so shaken in the 30s, had learned that war production could bring stability and high profits. Truman's anti-communism was attractive. The business publication Steel had said in November 1946, even before the Truman Doctrine, that Truman's policies gave the firm assurance that maintaining and building our preparations for war will be big business in the United States for at least a considerable period ahead. That prediction turned out to be accurate. At the start of 1950, the total U.S. budget was about $40 billion, and the military part of it was about $12 billion. But by 1955, the military part alone was $40 billion out of a total of $62 billion. A small but courageous movement against the military buildup, led by the War Resisters League and other groups, failed to stop it. In 1960, the military budget was $45.8 billion, 49.7% of the budget. That year, John F. Kennedy was elected president, and he immediately moved to increase military spending. In 14 months, the Kennedy administration added $9 billion to defense funds, according to Edgar Batome, The Balance of Terror. By 1962, based on a series of invented scares about Soviet military buildups, a false bomber gap, and a false missile gap, the United States had overwhelming nuclear superiority. It had the equivalent in nuclear weapons of 1,500 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs, far more than enough to destroy every major city in the world. The equivalent, in fact, of 10 tons of TNT for every man, woman, and child on Earth. To deliver these bombs, the United States had more than 50 intercontinental ballistic missiles, 80 missiles on nuclear submarines, 90 missiles on stations overseas, 1,700 bombers capable of reaching the Soviet Union, 300 fighter bombers on aircraft carriers able to carry atomic weapons, and 1,000 land-based supersonic fighters able to carry atomic bombs. The Soviet Union was obviously behind. It had between 50 and 100 intercontinental ballistic missiles and fewer than 200 long-range bombers. But the U.S. budget kept mounting. The hysteria kept growing. The profits of corporations getting defense contracts multiplied, and employment and wages moved ahead just enough to keep a substantial number of Americans dependent on war industries for their living. By 1970, the U.S. military budget was $80 billion, and the corporations involved in military production were making fortunes. Two-thirds of the $40 billion spent on weapon systems was going to 12 or 15 giant industrial corporations, whose main reason for existence was to fulfill government military contracts. Senator Paul Douglas, an economist and chairman of the Joint Economic Committee of the Senate, noted that 6/7 of these contracts are not competitive. In the alleged interest of secrecy, the government picks a company and draws up a contract in more or less secret negotiations. C. Wright Mills, in his book of the 50s, The Power Elite, counted the military as part of the top elite, along with politicians and corporations. These elements were more and more intertwined. A Senate report showed that the 100 largest defense contractors, who held 67.4% of the military contracts, employed more than 2,000 former high-ranking officers of the military. Meanwhile, the United States, giving economic aid to certain countries, was creating a network of American corporate control over the globe and building its political influence over the countries it aided. The Marshall Plan of 1948, which gave $16 billion in economic aid to Western European countries in 4 years, had an economic aim: to build up markets for American exports. George Marshall, a general, then Secretary of State, was quoted in early 1948 State Department bulletin. "It is idle to think that a Europe left to its own efforts would remain open to American business in the same way that we have known it in the past." The Marshall Plan also had a political motive. The communist parties of Italy and France were strong, and the United States decided to use pressure and money to keep communists out of the cabinets of those countries. When the plan was beginning, Truman's Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, said, "These measures of relief and reconstruction have been only in part suggested by humanitarianism. Your Congress has authorized and your government is carrying out a policy of relief and reconstruction today, chiefly as a matter of national self-interest." From 1952 on, foreign aid was more and more obviously designed to build up military power in non-communist countries. In the next 10 years, of the $50 billion in aid generated by the United States to 90 countries, only $5 billion was for non-military economic development. When John F. Kennedy took office, he launched the Alliance for Progress, a program of help for Latin America, emphasizing social reform to better the lives of people. But it turned out to be mostly military aid to keep in power right-wing dictatorships and enable them to stave off revolutions. From military aid, it was a short step to military intervention. What Truman had said at the start of the Korean War about the rule of force and the rule of law was again and again under Truman and his successors contradicted by American action. In Iran in 1953, the Central Intelligence Agency succeeded in overthrowing a government which nationalized the oil industry. In Guatemala in 1954, a legally elected government was overthrown by an invasion force of mercenaries trained by the CIA at military bases in Honduras and Nicaragua, and supported by 4 American fighter planes flown by American pilots. The invasion put into power Colonel Carlos Castillo Armas, who had at one time received military training at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The government that the United States overthrew was the most democratic Guatemala had ever had. The president, Jacobo Arbenz, was a left-of-center socialist. 4 of the 56 seats in the Congress were held by communists. What was most unsettling to American business interests was that Arbenz had expropriated 234,000 acres of land owned by United Fruit, offering compensation that United Fruit called unacceptable. Armas, in power, gave the land back to United Fruit, abolished the tax on interest and dividends to foreign investors, eliminated the secret ballot, and jailed thousands of political critics. In 1958, the Eisenhower government sent thousands of Marines to Lebanon to make sure the pro-American government there was not toppled by a revolution, and to keep an armed presence in that oil-rich area. The Democrat-Republican-Liberal-Conservative agreement to prevent or overthrow revolutionary governments whenever possible, whether communist, socialist, or anti-United Fruit, became most evident in 1961 in Cuba. That little island, 90 miles from Florida, had gone through a revolution in 1959 by a rebel force led by Fidel Castro, in which the American-backed dictator, Fulgencio Batista, was overthrown. The revolution was a direct threat to American business interests. Franklin D. Roosevelt's good neighbor policy had repealed the Platt Amendment, which permitted American intervention in Cuba. But the United States still kept a naval base in Cuba at Guantanamo, and U.S. business interests still dominated the Cuban economy. American companies controlled 80 to 100% of Cuba's utilities, mines, cattle ranches, and oil refineries, 40% of the sugar industry, and 50% of the public railways. Fidel Castro had spent time in prison after he led an unsuccessful attack in 1953 on an army barracks in Santiago. Out of prison, he went to Mexico, met Argentine revolutionary Che Guevara, and returned in 1956 to Cuba. His tiny force fought guerrilla warfare from the jungles and mountains against Batista's army, drawing more and more popular support. Then came out of the mountains and marched across the country to Havana. The Batista government fell apart on New Year's Day, 1959. In power, Castro moved to set up a nationwide system of education, of housing, of land distribution to landless peasants. The government confiscated over 1 million acres of land from 3 American companies, including United Fruit. Cuba needed money to finance its programs, and the United States was not eager to lend it. The International Monetary Fund, dominated by the United States, would not loan money to Cuba because Cuba would not accept its stabilization conditions, which seemed to undermine the revolutionary program that had begun. When Cuba now signed a trade agreement with the Soviet Union, the American-owned oil companies in Cuba refused to refine crude oil that came from the Soviet Union. Castro seized these companies. The United States cut down on its sugar buying from Cuba, on which Cuba's economy depended, and the Soviet Union immediately agreed to buy all the 700,000 tons of sugar that the United States would not buy. Cuba had changed. The good neighbor policy did not apply. In the spring of 1960, President Eisenhower secretly authorized the Central Intelligence Agency to arm and train anti-Castro Cuban exiles in Guatemala for a future invasion of Cuba. When Kennedy took office in the spring of 1961, the CIA had 1,400 exiles armed and trained. He moved ahead with the plans, and on April 17, 1961, the CIA-trained force, with some Americans participating, landed at the Bay of Pigs on the southern shore of Cuba, 90 miles from Havana. They expected to stimulate a general rising against Castro, but it was a popular regime. There was no rising. In 3 days, the CIA forces were crushed by Castro's army. The whole Bay of Pigs affair was accompanied by hypocrisy and lying. The invasion was a violation, recalling Truman's rule of law, of a treaty the U.S. had signed, the Charter of the Organization of American States, which reads, "No state or group of states has the right to intervene directly or indirectly, for any reason whatever, in the internal or external affairs of any other state." 4 days before the invasion, because there had been press reports of secret bases and CIA training for invaders, President Kennedy told a press conference, "There will not be, under any conditions, any intervention in Cuba by United States armed forces." True, the landing force was Cuban, but it was all organized by the United States, and American warplanes, including American pilots, were involved. Kennedy had approved the use of unmarked Navy jets in the invasion. 4 American pilots of those planes were killed, and their families were not told the truth about how those men died. The success of the liberal-conservative coalition in creating a national anti-communist consensus was shown by how certain important news publications cooperated with the Kennedy administration in deceiving the American public on the Cuban invasion. The New Republic was about to print an article on the CIA training of Cuban exiles a few weeks before the invasion. Historian Arthur Schlesinger was given copies of the article in advance. He showed them to Kennedy, who asked that the article not be printed, and the New Republic went along. James Reston and Turner Catledge of the New York Times, on the government's request, did not run a story about the imminent invasion. Arthur Schlesinger said of the New York Times action, "This was another patriotic act, but in retrospect I have wondered whether if the press had behaved irresponsibly, it would not have spared the country a disaster." What seemed to bother him and other liberals in the Cold War consensus was not that the United States was interfering in revolutionary movements in other countries, but that it was doing so unsuccessfully. Around 1960, the 15-year effort since the end of World War II to break up the communist radical upsurge of the New Deal and wartime years seemed successful. The Communist Party was in disarray, its leaders in jail, its membership shrunken, its influence in the trade union movement very small. The trade union movement itself had become more controlled, more conservative. The military budget was taking half of the national budget, but the public was accepting this. The radiation from the testing of nuclear weapons had dangerous possibilities for human health, but the public was not aware of that. The Atomic Energy Commission insisted that the deadly effects of atomic tests were exaggerated, and an article in 1955 in the Reader's Digest, the largest circulation magazine in the United States, said, "The scare stories about this country's atomic tests are simply not justified." In the mid-50s, there was a flurry of enthusiasm for air raid shelters. The public was being told those would keep them safe from atomic blasts. A government consultant and scientist, Herman Kahn, wrote a book on thermonuclear war, in which he explained that it was possible to have a nuclear war without total destruction of the world, that people should not be so frightened of it. A political scientist named Henry Kissinger wrote a book published in 1957, in which he said, "With proper tactics, nuclear war need not be as destructive as it appears." The country was on a permanent war economy, which had big pockets of poverty, but there were enough people at work making enough money to keep things quiet. The distribution of wealth was still unequal. From 1944 to 1961, it had not changed much. The lowest fifth of the families received 5% of all the income. The highest fifth received 45% of all the income. In 1953, 1.6% of the adult population owned more than 80% of the corporate stock and nearly 90% of the corporate bonds. About 200 giant corporations out of 200,000 corporations, 0.1% of all corporations, controlled about 60% of the manufacturing wealth of the nation. When John F. Kennedy presented his budget to the nation after his first year in office, it was clear that, liberal Democrat or not, there would be no major change in the distribution of income or wealth or tax advantages. New York Times columnist James Reston summed up Kennedy's budget messages as avoiding any sudden transformation of the home front, as well as a more ambitious frontal attack on the unemployment problem. Reston said, "He agreed to a tax break for business investment in plant expansion and modernization. He is not spoiling for a fight with the Southern conservatives over civil rights. He has been urging the unions to keep wage demands down so that prices can be competitive in the world markets and jobs increased. And he has been trying to reassure the business community that he does not want any Cold War with them on the home front." This week in his news conference, he refused to carry out his promise to bar discrimination in government-insured housing, but talked instead of postponing this until there was a national consensus in its favor. "During these 12 months, the president has moved over into the decisive middle ground of American politics." On this middle ground, all seemed secure. Nothing had to be done for blacks. Nothing had to be done to change the economic structure. An aggressive foreign policy could continue. The country seemed under control. And then in the 1960s came a series of explosive rebellions in every area of American life, which showed that all the system's estimates of security and success were wrong.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next